information using the time contact dependent model developed by the Germans. Now, the objections, and this is the major one, we've been able to do limbs and fingers, but we have not to date, using simple direct contact, been able to reproduce the face in an undistorted manner. The face is certainly most difficult because of the varied topology that happens spatially over a very short area. You get distortion if you apply a foreign substance to your face, touch a linen to it, such that every point on your face makes contact. Take that off, then you will obviously have distortion. So something beyond that very simple-minded hypothesis is needed. The other objection is there's apparent pressure independence for this phenomenon. Well, I don't know how strong a question that is. We've shown that the detail on the front is just about as dense or as complete as the detail on the backside of the image. So I don't know how strong that question is. The objection raised is that, well, with all that weight on there, with the weight of the body, the back image should be much denser than the top side, and it's not. Okay, so that's something that needs to be explained. Well, I should have had a chemist do this. None of the materials like the spices have been found on the shrouds. We've only found linen, which is a polysaccharide, cellulose, which is a polysaccharide. These, as I mentioned, these foreign substances may have indeed been consumed in the reaction or evaporated or whatever, we just don't know. So we have explained a lot of things. We know what the image is, but just how it got there still remains unexplained. I don't say it's unexplainable, but by as far as we've gone today, we cannot fully explain it. We have a hypothesis. The hypothesis needs more checking. We have to be more clever in designing some experiments to check this hypothesis. We have to also be more clever in preparing our test samples. Indeed, the presence of so much calcium, it's been suggested, may act as a buffering medium to prevent penetration of the reaction so that it stays at the surface. It may have something to do with very limited diffusion, which could give contour, that's diffusion, surface diffusion, which could give contour information. So the model is certainly incomplete. Is there a final slide?
That's it.
Okay. Well, that's all I have. Thank you.
Thank you, Sam. Do you have the lights, please? Can we please have the lights? House lights. House lights, please. Okay, before we conclude the morning session, I'd like to make a couple of announcements, final announcements. Number one, to reiterate, the members of the STIRP team are requested to meet at lunch. There will be a short meeting. Okay? Number two, the college reminds you that there's lunch available in the tent across the street. You are requested to feel free to wander around the campus, picnic on the green, enjoy the facilities that are here. Please.
Okay, I don't know.
At the, where are we going to eat lunch is where the meeting will be. Okay, just for more. We will try to have a question and answer period this afternoon. It's going to depend on time. I can't guarantee it, but we will try to do it. And, just as a passing comment, remember that all of us up here are expressing our, in many cases, either outside or inside, or expressing individual opinions about various things. They may or may not represent the opinions of the other members of the team, okay? 1:30, please. What time is it now? 1:30, please. If we can start promptly at 1:30, we got a good chance of getting Q&A in.
Counter-Terrorism Research Project Symposium. We're starting here just a little bit late, but I'm sure we'll do everything we can to make that up. The first speaker today is a man who really needs very little introduction, I think, because he wrote a book called The Shroud of Turin, which just about three years ago. He comes to us from England, and he has put together a theory of his own dealing with the possible history of the Shroud. Now, his work is, as is anything that just about anybody does, has some controversy about it. Some people agree, some people do not, but he wanted to discuss some objections as part of his talk to his thesis that have been raised. But I think you'll find Ian Wilson to be a very delightful person to listen to. And this is falls in the category of an invited paper. It's not really part of the Shroud of Turin Research Project, but we asked him to come because we thought it'd be something that you would enjoy hearing. So without further ado, I'd like to introduce Ian Wilson.
Thank you very much indeed, John. When I was invited to come over here about a month ago, just after I got back from the States and wasn't expecting to get back for another couple of... Sorry. Right. Can you hear me now? Thank you. Right. When... Now, is that all right? Yes, good. Right. Well, one of the things that STIRP said in their letter inviting me to come over here was this would just be a kind of informal family gathering. And so I thought it would just be a handful of people and didn't prepare that much. And then I see there's all of you. So anyway, I'm very pleased to be here. I suppose I must come into the category of what were called, I think, yesterday, the normal people. So far as historians can be normal. And essentially my area is very different from the scientific area, although I hope that one can apply certain scientific principles to the study of the historical questions relating to the Shroud. The problem with history, so far as the Shroud is concerned, is that while scientifically there seems so much evidence to support the Shroud's authenticity, historically it's been a dead duck for many years amongst the general run of historians because it has seemed you couldn't trace it back before the 14th century. And so everything that I'm going to put to you now is to show that there is a case for the cloth being in existence earlier, but what we cannot expect in the earlier centuries is that we're necessarily going to find references to a shroud and a shroud bearing a image of the full body of Jesus Christ. This has been the difficulty, that a shroud identifiable with the Turin Shroud does not seem to be recorded before one of the earliest and most mysterious references, which was in 1204, and that was to a cloth in Constantinople. You have references to shrouds in the earlier centuries, but there's no reference to these bearing images, and in most cases you can trace them to other cloths that are distinctly different from this one. So this is where you have a historical problem of some complexity, and what I'll try and do is show you very briefly how I've approached this, because, as I say, the two arguments that one really needs to look at are the question of, was this cloth we know today in history? And if it was, what was it? If we can have a look at the first slide, please. Don't need to dim the lights too much because they should be just a bit more, I think, dimming. Now this is a slide which simply goes back to the earliest representation we have of the shroud as we know it today, which is a pilgrim's amulet of the 14th century, the 1350s, when we know the shroud to have been in the possession of the Dashani family. And we have literary references which in fact say there was a lot of contention at the time that this cloth was a forgery. That is the earliest picture that we have of the cloth that we can say is definitely the shroud of Turin. Before then, we go into a distinctly murky area. But let's start thinking about this cloth from the point of view of an image of Jesus. If we look at the next slide, please, we can see what I call the conventional likeness of Jesus. That, in fact, was done in the 15th century by Van Eyck, and it's the type of likeness of Jesus that we instinctively look at and say, that's Jesus. Well, the question we need to ask is, why do we say of that particular likeness, that is Jesus? What tradition is there for that likeness? Were artists working from the shroud? Van Eyck could have been working from the shroud, because the shroud was certainly around in his time. But we do know that, in fact, he was working from a much earlier tradition. But just to show you that this is a portrait of Jesus very compatible with the shroud, let's look at the next slide. And what we can see is the negative that, that we're also familiar with on the right-hand side. But of course, anybody back in the early centuries, before the age of photography, would not have been able to see that. All they would have been able to see was this likeness on the left here. Now the question is, was this likeness done by somebody working in the 14th century copying the conventional likeness of Jesus, or was it the origin of the likenesses of Jesus that we have today? It is of the same type as we saw in that Van Eyck picture, the long hair, fork beard, long nose. How far can we then trace this likeness back? Let's go to the next slide, please. Now, this is some Byzantine portraits of the 11th century, or thereabouts, and we see that the same likeness is around. And we can, in fact, go right back. If we go back to onto the next slide now, we're just going back into time, trying to put every picture of Jesus through history into a kind of time machine. And we get back to this point, the 6th century, a silver vase, a likeness of Jesus, one found in Syria, and we can see that the artist who did this was portraying Jesus in virtually the identical manner that we see on the shroud. Let's try and go back though, just a bit further back into time. Next slide, please. We're now in 5th, 4th centuries, and what we're seeing is something different. We are seeing portraits of Jesus. The one, the earliest one, is the one from England, which is on the right, and it's definitely Jesus. It's got the Cairo monogram, but it's a beardless likeness, and we find in these earlier centuries we either have beardless likenesses or we have some bearded representations which have got none of the precision of these portraits from the 6th century on. So we're now into a question of saying, well, what caused everybody to be so precise from the 6th century on? We have also to look at literary references, which say in the earlier centuries, the 5th, 4th centuries and so on, St. Augustine is one person, for instance, who says we have no idea what Jesus looked like, what his earthly appearance was, and this is people theoretically closest to the time of Jesus, simply, even as early as the 4th century, exact details of his appearance had simply died out. There's no reference in the Gospels to what he looked like, whether he was bearded, clean-shaven, or what. So, how did these come about? Could it have been the shroud that was actually responsible for this new likeness of Jesus in art? Let's look at the next slide, please. Now, forgetting for the moment what the shroud might have been in history, there are some indications that the shroud was around. And I'd like to draw your attention to, if I can work this thing, Yes. To some details which were first brought to light by a very distinguished Frenchman whose grandson is in fact present here today. I refer to Monsieur Paul Vignon, who developed an iconographic theory back in the 1930s, which was showing that various Byzantine portraits of Christ had certain details to them which seemed to derive from the shroud. If you look at this picture with quite a naturalistic likeness, you should be able to make out a kind of topless square between the eyebrows here. The artist has been very naturalistic in many respects, but he put this very unnatural feature in. Now, why did he do this? If we look at the shroud, we can in fact see, and this is probably some irregularity in the weave or something we just don't know, is a kind of topless square exactly the same. Now, there are about 15 details which are all of them comparatively elusive. They don't occur, not all details occur in every portrait, but they keep on meandering in and out of Byzantine portraits. If you look at the next slide, for instance, what we'll see, this is a very famous Byzantine work of art, the Daphne Pantocrator. We can see the square there, which has in fact become rather stylized. There's a little triangle below the eyes here, quite meaningless so far as any natural feature is concerned. And yet, if we go back at the moment, can we turn back to the previous slide? We should be able to see that little triangle just under there. It's these sort of features that keep on recurring that seem to suggest that the shroud was around. Well, if so, what was it? If we go on now, two slides, please. The other interesting aspect to the whole question is the fact that while we may not have records of shrouds bearing images in existence before the, 1204, shall we say, what we do have is multitudinous references to images of Jesus' face on cloth. The most famous of these is, for instance, one you're probably familiar with, the Veronica. And this is a story of Saint Veronica, who was supposed to have rushed out in the streets of Jerusalem as Jesus was passing by on the road to Calvary and wiped his face. A very pious legend, which unfortunately, when you trace it back historically, has very little provenance, certainly in the form that it's come down to us today, earlier than about the 1300s, and seems to derive from an earlier cloth of which it was a copy. Now, there are many cloths like the Veronica, but the one they all seem to derive from is what we shall see on the next slide, mysterious one. This is the cloth called the Mandylion of Edessa, and this is, again like the Veronica, a cloth which seems to have had an image on it of Jesus. Most of the information we have is relating only to a face. The copies we have of it are many and varied, but as we study it more carefully, although that might not look to you as anything particularly relating to the shroud, as we go into it in more detail, we can see that there are all sorts of parallels. If we think for a moment that these people in the early centuries may have only been aware of the shroud in a folded form so that only the face was visible. Before I go on to the next slide, I'd just like to point out to you that here again we see some of these Vignon markings, little triangle here, a sort of, again, a stylized version of the forehead markings and so on. Many others, by the way, there's deformations to the nostrils and so on. But we're seeing these Vignon markings in copies of this cloth also. Next slide, please. Now, what do we know about the origin of this cloth and why is it that this one is thought of as the granddaddy of them all? Well, the story of how this cloth came into being is distinctly murky. Unfortunately, this is where historians are dealing in the stuff of legends and stories when one gets back to the first century AD, and to the reign of Abgar V, who was a monarch of this city here, a very scruffy little town called Urfa in eastern Turkey, but which was a distinguished city just outside the borders of the Roman Empire, sort of a buffer state between the Parthian and Roman empires in the first century AD. Now, according to the story about Abgar and this cloth, what happened was that Abgar was sick of a disease and sent a messenger, Jesus, asking him to come and cure him. Well, when the messenger arrived, it was seen that Jesus was already dead, and so a disciple by the name of Adai was sent with something which was later to be known as this cloth of Edessa. In the earliest records we have, about the 4th century AD, this something is referred to merely as a painted portrait, and its existence at that stage is not known, and it's obviously, the tradition about it is extremely vague. But then in the 6th century, and if you remember, it was the 6th century, which is when we noticed these portraits suddenly started to change. In the 6th century, we know that a startling discovery was made in the walls of the city of Edessa, above a gate of one of the walls. There was found immured in a niche this cloth that was supposed to have been given to Abgar all those years before. Now, when we get to the 6th century, we suddenly find that the whole story becomes transformed, and suddenly we are told that this was a divinely imprinted likeness of Jesus' face. There are stories at the time that it seems to have been created by some form of perhaps Jesus washing himself and wiping his face with it. This suggests a watery type of image, and we know how diffuse in appearance the shroud image is. So we get all sorts of indications like this that there was something of a shroud character involved. Other descriptions talk of it, a moist secretion without colouring or artificial stain. The cloth is brought in 944 to the Emperor of Constantinople. His sons are said to have found it extremely blurred. One historian suggests they might have been drunk at the time, but it is also, of course, possible that they were looking at the image of that we see on the Turin Shroud, and without the negative image, of course, they would have seen an image extremely blurred. Let's look now at the next slide, please. And we can just see on this one, one of the later icons that were made of this cloth, which is just showing the quaint details of the Abgar story. Now, the important thing, so far as this cloth is concerned, is not to take any one representation as being representative of the appearance of the original. Byzantine artists were quite notorious in terms of just changing things around to suit their particular whim. Very few of them would have had access to the original. But if we look at another likeness, we will see, next slide please, we will see that we're getting to have a picture of a face on what is usually a cloth which is set landscape-wise in relation to the face. Different from the normal portrait manner, an artist normally puts a portrait style. This is set landscape-wise. This seems to denote something of the original. Let's look at the next slide. And we can see that, in fact, this is one of the earliest representations of this cloth of Edessa. It shows an apparently disembodied head on, again, a rectangular piece of cloth. And if we look at the next, these baubles, by the way, you can forget those. These are just simply artist decoration. One gets all sorts of different decoration that occur in these pictures. But we are getting to build up a consistent picture of a disembodied head on a cloth. This is one of the most reliable likenesses because we know that it was very close to where the shroud, the cloth of Edessa was at the time. And that, in fact, the cloth was around and able to be viewed at the time. This is about the 11th century. We can see another one, if you turn to the next slide. This is in fact showing you now the shroud itself, and if we perhaps just can flick back momentarily to the other one, and then back again to the shroud, we can see that it is possible that the artists who were producing that previous picture were working from this sort of face, but they would not seem to have been aware of the body. Now, is there any justification for believing the shroud to have been, or this cloth of Edessa, to have been folded in at the time? Well, there is. One of the references to it describes it as having been tetradiplon, which means double in pore. And if, in fact, any of you would like to try the experiment of doubling a piece, a full-length representation of the shroud, and then giving it four more folds, so you literally double it in four, you will find that the face pops up in a disembodied style in exactly the manner that you see here. There seems, therefore, the possibility that it was in this form that the shroud was preserved in the early centuries. But again, one has to ask oneself, well, why should anybody want to present the shroud this way? Why were they not able to get at the access to the other elements of the cloth to see that it was a shroud? The answer here would seem to have been that we can detect from some of the representations and the literary descriptions that it was mounted on a board and was probably mounted in this way right back in the first century AD when it was brought to Edessa, when we can start to put ourselves in the minds of the people who came across this cloth in the tomb, hypothetically, nearly 2,000 years ago. I think, assuming that there was an image on the cloth at the time and it hadn't come about at a later stage, we would, with 20th century minds, expect them to go rushing around saying, "Eureka, look, here is a marvelous image of Jesus, this must be proof of the resurrection, and you know, let's make a big song and dance with this." We have to recognize that the first Christians were first and foremost Jews, and there were two things about this cloth which would have certainly caused them to have a lot of second thoughts about doing anything like that. The first aspect was that the shroud bore an image, and images were anathema to the Jews. They didn't go in for the same thing.